This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Jenna Siria, bookseller and associate producer of Poured Over, and today I am so excited to be joined by Amanda Montell, a linguistic mastermind, the author of Cultish and her new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, which truly from the moment I saw the cover sitting down, I was like, yes, this is something I need to talk about. She's also the host of one of my favorite podcasts, Sounds Like a Cult. And so today we are going to be talking all sorts of incredible linguistic and brain things. So Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my distinct pleasure. Thanks for having me and saying those nice things.
We have to start on the good vibes. And to continue that, a question that some authors hate, but I always have to ask, is what is the sort of elevator pitch for this book? Or could you just get it set up for our listeners? Because there's a lot going on.
Yes, absolutely. I don't hate that question. I love it. I've prepared for it, you know. So the book is called The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality, and it's about cognitive biases in the information age. So modern day DeLulu, if you will, know that term from the TikTok apparatus. So every chapter of the book is dedicated to a different cognitive bias, confirmation bias, and sunk cost fallacy are a couple of the most famous, but hundreds have been described. And I essentially chose my 11 faves, the ones that I thought were the most fascinating and the most relevant. And I use each of these biases as a lens to explore some mysterious irrationality plaguing the broader zeitgeist and my own life, exploring topics from extreme celebrity worship to weaponized nostalgia to Instagram manifestation gurus. So it was a really fun and cathartic thing to write.
From the second that I looked at the table of contents and saw like the headers with the biases that were going to go with it, I was like, oh, this is going to be so good, because I think it's a topic that seems daunting if you're like just looking at the textbook definitions of what all these things mean. It can be kind of confusing to understand how they relate to what we do on a day-to-day basis, especially because there's a lot of things where it's like, I don't want to think that I do that. And Then the more you think about it, you're like, oh no, I totally do that. So how did you come to this topic in a way that you were like, I have to write about this?
Yeah, well, the inspiration for this book was really born out of a lot of the research that I was doing for Cultish. So my last book is about the language of cults from Scientology to SoulCycle. And as I was looking into the mechanics of cult influence for that book, I kept coming across all this really fascinating psychology and behavioral economics research that made reference to cognitive biases, like the two that I mentioned, confirmation bias and sunk cost fallacy, that could explain why a person might join and stay in a cult for longer than makes sense to anyone else. But I couldn't help but notice that these cognitive biases could explain not just the cult behaviors I was looking into, but so many of my own behaviors, behaviors of individuals in my life, behaviors of people I would interact with online. And it quickly became clear that, you know, these mental magic tricks that we play on ourselves, these like deep-seated psychological shortcuts that we've always taken as human beings to help us make sense of the world enough to survive it, have really clashed with the information age. There's been this really explosive collision between our innate irrationalities and this time in history when we're tasked with knowing everything under the sun or being responsible with being right about everything because you could find out the answer to any question with a quick Google search. You know, there's some inherent tension between those two concepts. And so cognitive biases, just learning a little bit about them already helped me feel like, oh my gosh, this really explains why, even though we're living in the information age, the world only seems to be making less and less sense.
Especially so much in the past, you know, unfortunate 4 or 5 years we've been having, where it's like, these unprecedented times, these uncertain times. And I'm like, please, can we just get back to precedented times? But I don't know that we will. It seems like there's so much more pressure on individuals to like interact with information and to understand it. And there's so much more, I guess, misinformation and this bombardment through social media or through advertising to sort of I guess, I don't want to say control how we think, but sometimes that is how it feels. And so I think in many ways, these things seem more important than ever.
Yeah. Well, you know, the democratization of information is mostly a wonderful thing. You know, like it's so cool how, you know, there's such a low barrier to entry to learning things. However, you know, the human mind is not meant to confront the onslaught of news and information, both true and false, and, you know, identities, human beings that we now perceive en masse on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, while I would objectively not trade the present for precedent at times, although I do like that term, and I do have a chapter in the book that discusses the cognitive bias of declinism, which describes our penchant to think that, you know, life and society are just getting irreversibly worse and worse and worse, that, you know, and there's no going back. And that is a kind of cognitive analog to nostalgia, which there are benefits to nostalgia hugely. And I talk about in the book as well. But I think, you know, during painful times, like right now, we tend to sort of like sink into the warm bath of the past or romanticizations of the past in order to generate hope for the future. But what is absolutely true right now is that even though having access to so much information is amazing, and I wouldn't trade it for the 1800s, Lord knows I wouldn't, it also is really challenging and painful for the human mind. We're just like not capable of handling it all. And so really with this book, I was hoping to understand for myself and then, you know, create some connective tissue for us all to understand why it just mysteriously feels so hard to exist as a human in the world right now.
Yeah, I agree that like I can't go back in time and live in any other time. I'm barely faring well now.
I know, a time before antibiotics, a time before women's rights of any kind, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like I absolutely glamorize the past. I have this like, well, I'm actually really interested, and I do talk about this in that declinism chapter. I'm really interested in like people's attempts to marry the best of the distant past, like nostalgia for a time we've never known, with all the modern comforts and technological advances of the present / near future. So like I do this, I have this little lamp that looks like a candlestick that you might see like, you know, little Mary from the Secret Garden carrying around that giant mansion, you know, like looks like something out of olden times. But it's LED. So like, I love nothing more than to be able to like control that little wick, which like never burns out. It does run out of charge, but I like to recharge it. And just like, you know, like creep around my house like a little cholera-stricken girl who existed long before the woes of the internet. But it's just pretend. It's just pretend.
I think about that when I was like, when everyone was very into like sourdough starters and like baking and doing all these things. And I'm like, yes, I'm going to get into that. I'm going to learn how to, you know, craft to make my own Pop-Tarts at home. And then I'm like, well, I can just go buy them. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but on a serious note, like it's no accident that the whole tradwife movement was born out of the pandemic, which like, you know, if you engage in crafting and a little bit of casual light homesteading, there's nothing wrong with that. But there are, you know, religious and right-wing fanatics who have weaponized that Laura Ingalls Wilder aesthetic to perpetuate some really backwards ideas about women and where women belong. So all of these trends and proclivities, they're all a double-edged sword.
I think that is so important, especially in trying to use these things, not as like, you know, warning bells that everything is so awful or that everything is out to get you, but just to sort of enforce your own ability to make choices, whether it comes to things like that or sort of on the like new age aspect of like a lot of Instagram sort of like therapists and things like that, where they're putting out these like soundbite infographics of information that may or may not have truth and things behind it that we have to be like, oh, wait, let me think about this a little bit more before I really delve in.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's one of the things that this constant, very fast-paced onslaught of information has caused is it's really forcing our attention spans to shrink. And how could they not shrink with the amount of information that we're tasked with, you know, navigating? But I find that an awareness of cognitive biases alone, and really I'm only hyper familiar with these 11, but there have been, you know, dozens more that have been described. But even just an awareness of these key 11 has been hugely helpful for my personal life decisions. I mean, the one that I keep coming back to, there are so many that I keep coming back to, but the one that comes to mind in this moment is this bias toward additive solutions. I talk about this in a very personal chapter called A Toxic Relationship is Just a Cult of One, a note on the sunk cost fallacy, which I've mentioned a few times now, and describes our erroneous penchant to believe that resources already sunk into an endeavor, time, money, or even an emotional resource like hope justify spending even more. So it's why, you know, on a lighter note, you might be 100 episodes into a TV show that you've decided you hate, but you're like, oh, I'm this far in. I can't give up now. I have to watch the whole thing. But also, it might cause you to spend, in my case, many, many formative years in a relationship that's damaging to you. So while researching that chapter, I came across this pretty fascinating study that reflected our bias toward solving problems, either like physical problems, math problems, or emotional problems by adding things to the equation. So this study had to do with like presenting people with a set of blocks and they had to solve an issue in like the shape or arrangement of the blocks by either adding or subtracting blocks. And it was fascinating to find that the vast majority of people attempted to solve the solution with a more complicated additive tactic, rather than a more simple solution involving just taking one block away. Now, when I was in my toxic cult-like relationship, succumbing to the sunk cost fallacy, which is related to additive and subtractive bias, I was like, you know what? In order to cure this relationship of all that ails it, we just need to go on another vacation, or we just need to get another cat. No regrets on the cats, but we just need to add this and that, another gadget, another, you know, I was about to say another person. I wish that would have, maybe that would have solved it, you know, a threesome or two. I'm kidding. But, you know, I was like, and this can apply to all kinds of problems. You know, I encountered a problem with my sleep where I was like, you know what I need to do to have better sleep? I need to get a fancier alarm clock and I need to add some supplements and I need to get this app. Really, both of those problems could have been much more simply solved with a subtractive solution by breaking up with that person and by just stopping caffeine after 1 p.m., you know? But we are not biased toward those types of solutions, especially not in consumerist society when we're taught to believe that, like, you just need to buy things to solve all your problems. So becoming aware of that bias is such a simple concept, but becoming aware of it has really helped me make business decisions and other kinds of life decisions. You know, when you're feeling bad or sad or out of control, I don't know how many other people, you know, subscribe to like a retail therapy philosophy, but like I will sometimes truly think like buying something will save me. Just know, having that empirical study to prove that that's not the case, that's just one example of the ways that, you know, learning about so-called magical overthinking has really helped me in a material way.
Truly, like 2 months ago, I just had like the weirdest month of dreams because I thought if I just keep taking this melatonin that's making me lose my mind, I will get better sleep. Nope, I stopped taking it. We're good to go.
I know we so badly want to add things to the equation to help us when sometimes we just need to take something away.
And I think when we're thinking about sort of the cognitive biases in those terms, it's easy to be like, well, that's very, I guess, low stakes, or, you know, yes, this will help me, but I don't need to think too much about it. But it's also very easy for things to become incredibly high stakes, especially in sort of an era of misinformation that we're occupying right now. A lot of people that are peddling that are preying on some of these biases in people.
100%. Yeah. You know, you were mentioning that like on the surface, these sort of behavioral economics concepts can feel a bit intimidating. What I actually found is that the cognitive biases themselves are really easy to understand. Like one that comes to mind in light of the comment you just made is this one that I talk about in the book called The Illusory Truth Effect, which describes kind of in summary, our proclivity to think that just because we've heard something multiple times, then it must be true. And it really highlights the power of repetition in political rhetoric and other kinds of dogmas. But also there is a low stakes version of that where, you know, just because I heard beer before liquor, never been sicker, liquor before beer, you're in the clear in college a million times, that I thought it was true when it wasn't. So there are like low stakes and high stakes applications of that bias. But I find that when you learn what the bias is, also related to a point that you made, you immediately write it off as like, oh my God, like what an absurd irrationality that has nothing to do with my life. But what I really aim to do with my book is humanize and personalize and contextualize these cognitive biases in a way that certainly doesn't feel like reading an academic paper, but that also invites us all to be like, wait a second, you know, I thought that only ding-dongs would be susceptible to the illusory truth effect or additive solution bias or even something like the sunk cost fallacy, but wait a second, I think this actually applies to me.
The one that really got me was the recency illusion. And just because you're like seeing something a lot right now, all of a sudden it's like, this must be true. This must be the most important thing. And I'm like, that gets me, especially within like algorithms and things. It's like, well, of course I'm seeing this a million times. I interact
with it. I'm engaging with it. Yeah.
It's bringing me to it. I'm bringing it to me. It's like, my algorithm is my own fault.
For sure. Yeah, no, that chapter was very cathartic for me. The recency illusion is this bias referencing our inclination to think that because something is new to us, that it must be new, period. And that when something is new, it's worthy of our attention and or full throttle panic. So, you know, in the hunter-gatherer period, for example, when you noticed like a rustling in the bushes that could pose a potential threat to you, it didn't matter if that thing was really objectively new or just new to you. The fact that you were noticing it meant that it needed to be addressed and you should probably run away. And even if you were being overdramatic and it wasn't actually like a predator or something like that, the stakes are too high. No harm done in just running away just in case. But now we are applying those same like ancient panic responses to what we see in our social feeds or what we see in the news. And that relationship or that clash is really what I talk about in that chapter. Cause I am such a skilled panicker. I would have been an amazing hunter-gatherer. No, I'm kidding. That's me romanticizing that period once again. I probably would have died at the age of like 3.
I recently sent an article to a friend about some sort of like environmental disaster. And I was like, I can't believe I didn't hear about this. Like, why is someone talking about it? Like, I was so upset. And my friend was like, that is from February of last year. And I was like, oh, copy. And was like, but it was so easy for me to be like in a true panic about something that I read on, you know, that really didn't look any further into it because my brain was 7 steps ahead of me.
Totally. Especially because, you know, that's in response to like an actual crisis. If it's something related to the climate, there are so many news outlets who are intentionally or unintentionally capitalizing on the recency illusion in order to generate panic so that we engage with their content, buy their products, use their affiliate links, etc. I mean, I talk about this a bit in the book that my day job for years before I switched to writing about this fun stuff was as a beauty editor, which was like total happenstance. That was not my aspiration. But it, you know, it was cool. I learned how to put on eyeshadow. But I, you know, my job as a beauty editor was often to generate panic over problems that were not even real, much less new and urgent, you know, things having to do with wrinkles and, you know, deep bloating things and whatever. And so, I mean, even though I was seeing how the sausage was made and I was basically in like a clickbait factory, I was still susceptible to it. And I still am, except for that now I'm so grateful to be aware of the recency illusion. And now that I am, I see it everywhere.
The Bravo celebs get me on that all the time. They put some wild stuff in their stories and they're like, click that link in my bio. And I'm like, it's never anything. I need to learn.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. We are such skilled panickers, we human beings.
I think especially now when, like you said, there's just like such a wealth of information that our brains are just not equipped to handle it. And especially, I think, because we're such social creatures, that like that inclination to share and to like assume in certain ways that you'll be seeing truthful things, even though we know so well that like that is not the case.
Isn't that quaint? It's like every time I write a book where I set out with like a slightly more cynical stance, like, oh, people who wind up in cults, those ding-dongs, I want to keep using that word.
I love that.
Feel safe. Or like, oh, these cognitive biases, ha ha ha, like I'm too smart for these. Or like human beings, oh God, we're such duds, like we're so silly, you know. Then I look into it a bit more and I end up feeling more optimistic about our species. It's like, yes, we are social creatures. It isn't a bad thing that we're so trusting. It's just that, you know, we have a responsibility now to recognize these qualities in us that might not be inherently bad, but are colliding with the technological culture that we've created.
It just always makes me wonder why we are so obsessed with sort of dissecting this and dissecting language and trying to understand these things. I know there are a million like podcasts and books and things of people just always trying to get that next grasp. And you do it so well in combining the sort of academic piece of it and really giving a lot of good information to set a foundation. But then there are so many like anecdotes and funny stories from people you've talked to that it makes it very palatable and understandable and more compassionate, I guess, to understand all of it. But I always go back to like, why are we so obsessed with this?
I mean, I think it just comes back to like the big mystery of why are we here on this earth? Like, humans, you know, like, and why are we the way we are? And how do we make our lives feel meaningful while we are here? And I think, you know, for me, I derive a lot of meaning from understanding my behavior and the behavior of others. I derive a lot of meaning from sharing what I've learned. And I hope that my work feels like not just like something that you can learn from, but something that feels, you know, emotional and yeah, very human. Cause I love taking scientific studies or, you know, fascinating fun facts about social science and making something artistic out of them if I can. This book is really like my attempt at creating meaning out of my own life and trying to answer that question of like, why am I here and how can I make my life worthwhile while I am?
This book does feel a lot more personal to you than Cultish and than some of your other work, because not only just that you have a lot more of your own anecdotes and sort of your own life in there, but it just feels like a true passion project in a lot of ways.
Oh, thanks.
And I think you can really sense it as you read that there is so much of you in this. And I wonder how it feels to put that out.
It feels so good. I mean, I said something very dramatic at the end of my acknowledgments. And I was like, now that I've written this book, I can die happy, you know? But like, it is. It really does feel like a culmination of everything that's ever fascinated me, everything I've ever cared about. I feel like it represents my voice kind of exactly as I want it to be represented, at least, you know, right now at the age of 32. I'm sure in 5 years I'll be like, oh, that book. But as of right now, I feel really proud of it. I feel like, you know, I gave everything I had to the book. And I'm also really grateful for my editor and, you know, all my early readers on the project, because it does cover a lot of ground. And earlier drafts of the book did feel, to quote my editor, over-caffeinated. you know, I am an overthinker, like that's why I wrote this. And so there were a lot of thoughts that needed to be reined in to make the book feel cohesive and grounded and sensible. And, you know, I couldn't be more pleased with the result. Oh, well, I probably could be, but my confirmation bias is telling me that this is exactly what I wanted it to be in the end.
I really think it helps to connect so many of those things with true stories from someone where you're like, oh, I not only am I able to understand this because I can put myself there, but you want to connect and combine your story with someone else's to be like, oh yeah, I've totally been there. And I think people will be so excited to hear about your seat cushion.
Oh my God. I posted it on my Instagram story yesterday. I don't know if you saw. I'm sitting on it right now.
There it is.
This is it.
That cushion is famous.
It's going to be famous. I know. I'm so glad I kept it, you know, because I can't bring myself to throw it away. Not only because I'm proud of it, but because it works, you know, like my derriere is as cozy as can be because of this thing. You know, I would be lost without it.
I think it's very important. I think we need like an Age of Magical Overthinking line of seat cushions. I'm not saying, but I think it could be a great tie-in moment.
That feels like something that Miranda July would do. You know how like when Miranda July puts out a book, or at least when she put out her last novel, The First Bad Man, I think there was like a line of objects from the book that you could purchase online. There are like so many little artifacts in this book that I feel very connected to, that I hope that readers latch on to. I love that IKEA effect chapter is resonating with people. So
yeah,
for those who are like, what is going on with the seat cushion thing? The last chapter in the book is about this bias called the IKEA effect, which gotta love the name, but it describes our proclivity to believe that just because we've helped create something with our own hands, that it must be more valuable. So it explains why, you know, I tell a story in that chapter about my stint as an amateur furniture flipper, where during the pandemic, my best friend and I, to, you know, keep ourselves busy, would, you know, find dilapidated homewares, either like in the back of our own closet or, you know, like from friends who wanted to get rid of stuff. And we would flip it, in scare quotes, because we have no DIY skills, but we would essentially like wipe it down, maybe slap a coat of paint on it, like do the least. And we genuinely thought that these objects could sell for millions of dollars. We were like, we are like, these objects are so precious. And of course, the title of this bias connects to IKEA products, which require some assembly to build. And we, you know, value our dressers so much more when we laid a hand in them. And in that chapter, I incorporate, you know, my takes on AI and stuff like that. You know, how much does a human hand have to be involved in something for it to be valuable? And then I also make an argument for, you know, DIY crafts. There is a fun fact in there about how knitting is found to increase happiness in depressive knitters. So, I mean, a little knit, how about that? Not like knitting will solve every last one of your problems. But anyway, I tell the story of my creation of this totally underwhelming seat cushion in that chapter. And it's really been fun to see how early readers have embraced it.
I just think everybody has something like that in their home or like wherever, where it's like, oh, this is ostensibly garbage, and yet it is my garbage and it will stay right here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, again, we human beings are so quaint. Like, even grown adults, when participating in studies, will like build some totally pathetic looking piece of furniture. And at the end of the study, they're like, can I show this to my mom? So, like, it's so adorable how much we want to participate in things, how much we want to contribute to the creation of things. And yeah, it's, I can't wait for more readers to interact with that concept.
But I do think there we're onto something with having some tie-in items. I'm even thinking about what Miranda July's next book, All Fours, is going to have for tie-in items. I can already think of some. And
totally. Oh my God. Well, I was very, very blessed to get to go to like a preview party for that book, where there were, you know, little gift bags, and I got a galley and I devoured it instantly. But we did get some hotel keychains that said like Excelsior Room 321 or whatever it was. Yeah, no, for sure. My line of objects would absolutely include a seat cushion. It would include certainly maybe some dinosaur temporary tattoos.
Oh yeah, that's important.
I would have to. I'm gonna keep noodling on this. I really like this notion.
I think it should also include a t-shirt that says "Haters are my motivators," but
well, yeah,
and
of course,
with the jacket like printed on it. I think that's
love that.
Really important.
Yeah. Absolutely love that. Yeah. I mean, I did create a really cute sticker sheet as like a piece of marketing merch for the book that has like, you know, a little sticker that says manifest, but wink. Because there's a whole chapter that argues that manifestation is just a positive spin on conspiratorial thinking. So, yeah, there's a lot to play with.
There's a lot to play with. There's so much in this book where, like, I found, like, I read it so quickly. The first time I looked through it, I was just like, I need to devour it. And now I'm like, uh-huh. I feel like there's pieces I want to go back to because there's so much in there, especially research-wise. I feel like your books always have so much in terms of sources that are really unique and connect in a way that I don't quite expect. And you always have like great anecdotes from people. So I'd love Thanks. To hear a little bit about your research process and Ooh. Some of the cool people you get to talk to make these books happen.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. So the research process presented itself more clearly with Word Slut and Cultish. The task with Word Slut was to take an existing field of study, that being feminist sociolinguistics, and translating it, curating it, filtering it through my voice for a general audience. And so that really just involved combing through basically every source that I came across in the sex, gender, and language course that I took in college, and doing some first-person interviews with linguists currently working in the field. And, you know, taking that like massive body of literature and just sort of, yeah, serving as a custodian of it, if you will, a curator of it. Then with Cultish, that was a bit more a work of straight reporting. So, you know, I knew I wanted to write about this vast spectrum of cultish groups. I chose the cult categories that I thought would be most of interest and that seemed, you know, like they were begging to be included. So my interviews consisted of, and there were, oh my gosh, there were dozens upon dozens of interviews that consisted of, you know, talking to everyone from Heaven's Gate survivors to SoulCycle instructors. But that was, you know, a bit more of a traditional reporting project. With this, it's such a sort of genre blendy book that I could kind of do whatever I wanted. So I certainly conducted a great many interviews with mental health experts, psychologists, behavioral economists, even folklorists. So, you know, those conversations were all really informative and provided the foundation of knowledge that I would need to then go and, you know, fly off the handle with my little ideas. And then I just sort of, well, okay. And then I read a great deal of source material. So, you know, fantastic books from Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson is a wonderful book on confirmation bias. You know, those sort of, well, it's not pop psychology. Those sort of like psychology books for general audiences. But then I would also read for inspiration books like John Green's The Anthropocene Reviewed, because there's such a sense of wonder in that book. And I really wanted to bring a sense of wonder to this book. Of course, it must be acknowledged that Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking was, you know, the title of this book is like a bit of a nod to that, because when I read that book, how old was I the first time that I read that book? I don't know. I was quite young. That was my first exposure to this concept of magical thinking, you know, the idea that our internal thoughts and feelings can affect external events. And then magical overthinking is this riff on that where, you know, I think while magical thinking is this age-old human quirk, overthinking is distinct to the modern age. And so, you know, this clash between information and our innate mysticisms, that's magical overthinking. So, you know, obviously I dipped back into a whole bunch of Didion and it's so much source material in terms of books that I read. But then there are a lot of other, like, there's a wide range of references in this book. One of my epigraphs is the Kendrick Lamar lyric, you know, I'm quoting Virginia Woolf. I interviewed some of my extremely brilliant friends, like Coco Mellors, who's a novelist who wrote most recently Blue Sisters, which is coming out soon, and also Cleopatra and Frankenstein. I interviewed my dear friend Koa Beck, who's the author of the incredible book White Feminism. So I was just like, I almost joke that it was like my goodbye tour. It was like, I was almost like, I'm going to die after this book. I need to like interview literally anyone, everyone I've ever known, admired, loved. And like the book is dedicated to my partner. The first chapter is in great detail about my mom, you know, like it's really, I was just kind of given free rein to do whatever I wanted with it. So yeah, you will get like behavioral economics studies and Sylvia Plath and, you know, Taylor Swift all referenced within the same paragraph sometimes.
And that's what makes it so fun. And that's what makes it, I mean, I guess fun is the right word, but there are definitely things in here that I would say maybe are decidedly not fun. But as I was going through, the sense of like play and back and forth and sort of like the buoyancy in the writing brings you through those like tougher moments where you're like, okay. And then it all wraps together. I think the tonal balance really works. And I think that can be something that's challenging in this kind of nonfiction to say, yeah, there's going to be, I want to make a lot of jokes, but I also have to talk about serious stuff. But it all comes together.
Yeah, thank God this was not my first book. Let me tell you, like, because in the writing of Word Slut, I learned so much about crafting that tonal balance. Let me tell you, in draft one of Word Slut, there were so many stupid jokes that my editor was just like, get out of here. You know, it's like, this isn't like, this isn't Twitter. Like, I've never even been on Twitter, which is great for me. But there's just like a certain authority that you need to bring to book writing, and coming to own my authority was a process. But I am so glad that I have moved past the sort of like growing pains that I experienced during the writing of Word Slut with you know, that balance of humor and authority and scholarship. Because if I hadn't had that experience, there's no way I would have been able to pull off this book.
And I think that that sort of shows in a natural progression of your work from Word Slut into Cultish into this, that you're sort of finding a footing of combining your own life with this more academic piece. And now we're really in like that great middle zone of like, yep, these are stories from my life and I'm combining them, and it just flows into something.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it took a certain amount of confidence that only comes in your 30s. Oh, I'll just speak for myself. That has only come in my 30s to be able to be like, you know what? I finally feel good enough about my life to justify incorporating it into my work.
I totally get that. Was there anything that you couldn't fit in that you really wish you could have, or something that really surprised you while you were writing this?
Yeah, you know, weirdly, I had the opposite issue with this book to Cultish. With Cultish, there was so much that ended up on the cutting room floor, like just dozens of cult-like groups that I could have addressed in the book. And that's why I launched my podcast, Sounds Like a Cult, because I was like, this is a way to continue talking about the subject matter, of course, in a much more lighthearted way. With this book, though, like the first draft ended up being too short, actually, because I was like hyper aware of wanting it to feel tightly edited. And then we got to that point and my editor was like, it's a little slim. And I was like, OK, what can I do? So at the last minute, I added that declinism chapter about nostalgia. And I'm so glad I did, because I'm noticing from a lot of early readers that it's one of their favorite chapters. And it's the one that has really like had the most lingering effect on me, I think. Like, I continue to be fascinated by nostalgia and I want to explore that more. There were plenty of concepts that I was only able to bloop, like sort of touch on, or that were kind of like tangentially related to one of the central themes of the book, that I am also actually now incorporating into a new podcast project called Magical Overthinkers, which I'm going to be launching in the middle of May, where every episode is overthinking about blank, overthinking about blank, overthinking about blank. Some very like zeitgeisty topic that we can't stop thought spiraling about as a culture. And I'm interviewing these really brilliant scholars to help us like stop overthinking about all of these topics, from narcissism to cannibalism. So there is that. There was actually one chapter that I considered including as well at the last minute and ultimately decided to cut, because it wasn't really about a cognitive bias. It was about like some other mysticism or some other like irrational belief, but that wasn't like a true cognitive bias. So it didn't really quite seem to work. But I actually am going to be reading that chapter as a little bonus on my podcast, Sounds Like a Cult. Sorry, I'm doing so much podcasting, like literally what is wrong with me.
But truly so many of our listeners are podcast fiends. So
fiends, that makes sense. Yes. You're here, you're listening to a podcast. So there we go. Yeah, if you're interested in hearing that cut chapter, I will be sharing it on Sounds Like a Cult the week that the book comes out. That one is called Witching Hour, A Note on Mind-Body Dualism. So amazing. Keep an eye out. Or an ear out.
I love that. I always wonder when authors have these new books coming out, is there someone that you really hope finds this book? Do you have like a perfect reader in mind?
Ooh, I love that question. I mean, truly anyone who is reckoning with this struggle between living in the information age and only feeling like life is making less and less sense, I feel like will really connect with this book. I say sometimes that, you know, with everything that I write, I'm really just trying to generate more skepticism of myself and more compassion toward other people. And that's what I want to give to readers, because I learned writing this book that it is really hard to change other people's minds, but it's not as hard to change your own mind. So yeah, that's what that's, you know, but readers who are open to that, I hope find the book.
And they will. I have a very strong sense that people are really going to come to this with something that changes their mind. It's going to, if they come to it with an open mind, they're going to get something truly wonderful out of it, because I found something to connect to on every page. So I can't wait for readers to get their hands on this. Amanda Montell, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
If you haven't read Cultish yet, I really recommend getting your hands on it, because it is wonderful. Sounds Like a Cult, a great podcast, and sounds like there's a new podcast coming. So that is truly exciting as well. But most importantly, The Age of Magical Overthinking is out now, and you have to read it. So thank you so much.
Oh, it was so much fun. Thank you.
Hello, readers. It's time for another TBR Top Off. We're going to recommend a couple of fantastic books to pick up when you stop in for your copy of The Age of Magical Overthinking. I'm Mark at my Barnes & Noble in Cincinnati, and I'm joined by my very good book buddy, Jamie, in Leawood, Kansas. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Mark.
I'm going to go ahead and kick things off, because I am racing through this book right now, and I have to recommend it and talk to everybody about it. I'm sure my coworkers and fellow booksellers are getting slightly annoyed, but I don't care. I'm recommending The Book of Delights by Ross Gay. I love this book so much. It's fantastic. I love it. It is like, I feel like this is a great dessert to The Age of Magical Overthinking, where, you know, Montell's work has a bit more of a, almost an academic structure. It's a social sciences look, whereas Ross Gay's book is more of a, now here's what you do with some of that information, and something that maybe will make you go less insane in this world that is seemingly falling apart. Ross Gay is a very famous poet. His work is gorgeous. I am happy to devour anything that he puts to paper. But this particular book is a collection of essayettes, or baby essays, or mini essays, two pages each, let's say, that he started on a birthday, I think 42, where every day he wanted to write a small piece about something that gives him a delight or a joy. Does that for a full year, and then compiles them into a book. And the ways that he has found connecting points from the things that he's observed, the things that he's bringing to mind that give him joy or that cause a delight in his brain and his heart and his soul, and how they start to kind of develop a life of their own and almost a community within this book. And the things that he's recognizing are also delights that are coming out of the woodwork and saying, don't forget us, pay attention to us as well. It's just, it's such a beautiful experiment. I love it. And in his hands, just a chef's kiss. It's so much fun. I think the challenge that I'm having with the book is that I am trying to pace myself and just read like one or two a day to kind of pace myself along with his trajectory. Not the case. I have eaten up so much of this book in the matter of just days, and I don't want to stop, but I will be going back through and reading it all over again because it's just that much fun. So he talks about things like interactions with the natural world, be it like a hummingbird that he sees in his garden, or very innocuous but very powerful interactions with strangers, the way that he thinks about his family when he thinks about a certain song or a certain piece of art. And each of these things, it's not a very giddy book about like, all of these things are great. It's more of a, these things are making me think about something. I'm pulling the delight out of circumstances, because some of the things he has to say are very, very serious. But again, in his hands, the way that he crafts each of these small little delicious pieces is worth it. I think from page one, you will be ready to just dive into his world and see things through his eyes. I think he gives almost like a beautiful permission and really just begs us to pay attention a little bit more to the things around us and to relish and just take a little bit of solace in the small awes and joys that are in our own trajectory. So please, please, please check out The Book of Delights by Roske. I love it so, so much. Jamie, what do you have for us?
That's a perfect book to give to people too, I think, for to someone special.
Yes.
It makes a great gift. I decided to lean into the science, the hard science here, and I'm going to recommend The Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark by the fantastic Carl Sagan. You cannot have grown up a nerd in the 70s and not have crushed hard on Carl Sagan in Cosmos, or at least I did. He made me the skeptic I am today. Plus, his turtlenecks. I just couldn't get enough. At any rate, this book is, I feel like I revealed maybe a lot about myself there. Okay,
I love it. Book, I love it.
was published in 1996. And so, you know, fairly late in his life. But I think the topics in Amanda Montell's book really demonstrate how relevant he still is today. He was just so enthusiastic in his wonder and his awe about the universe. And he understood that each of us are united in that wonder, but he was going to stand firm. He stood firm in his insistence that we must be rigorous. We must employ critical thinking and the scientific method when we're looking at the natural world. And he really warns against pseudoscience and superstition and any other easy answers. He'll explore a topic like alien abduction, right? It was big in the 90s. And he is full of compassion to the believers, but he returns again and again to evidence. He says that the more extraordinary the claim, the more extraordinary the evidence for that claim should be. He acknowledges that the unknown is very frightening, and so people are going to naturally grasp at explanations. But he says that science, by questioning and investigating, acts as a candle in that to illuminate that darkness. And we should really rally around it instead of seeking illogical, easy answers all the time. One of the things I really love about this book and about anything that Sagan did is that he made science accessible to us normals. And he certainly did that on his show Cosmos, but his books, they're the same. These are a great way for people who are not scientists to understand really complicated concepts. And he does such a great job of breaking them down and making them accessible to us. No one should be afraid of reading this book. He never talks down to you. Instead, he tries to bring everybody up, right, to his degree, his level of enthusiasm for all the wonders of the universe. Pick it up. I know you're going to understand it. And if you like the Montell book, I know you'll just love this. It will also make you look very smart when it's sitting on your shelf. I haven't looked at the physical copy lately, but I'm wondering if there might be a picture of him and another great turtleneck blazer combo on the back. I'm not sure. Apologies for my Carl Sagan obsession. But anyway, I think I really do think anybody could read and love this book, and that's The Demon Haunted World.
Fantastic job, as expected. Yeah. Thank you very much. But that's all we have for today. Thanks so much for tuning in to Poured Over. Please make sure to give us a rating and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can also follow us on our socials at Barnes & Noble. I am Mark. You can follow my home store at BN Westchester. Jamie, where can we find you?
I'm Jamie. You can follow my home store at BN Leewood KS.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Happy reading. Hiya.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.